All right, our next case is 10-2138, James Spencer versus FHI LLC et al. Mr. Hendershot, for the appellants.
Madam Chief Justice, and may it please the court, I would like to set aside 2 minutes for rebuttal. The right to appeal from Industrial Commission decisions to the Common Pleas Court is a right defined and delimited by statute. By statute, the General Assembly determines what prerequisites that appeal are jurisdictional. In Revised Code 4123.512b, the General Assembly has determined that the separate requirements to name the administrator of the Bureau of Workers' Compensation as a party and to serve him with a copy of a notice of appeal are each jurisdictional. Here, the claimant complied with neither requirement. This court should therefore reverse the Second District and reinstate the trial court's decision, dismissing the case for lack of subject matter jurisdiction. The administrator urges that result for three reasons: the text and the history of the statute, the surrounding context of Chapter 4123 of the Revised Code, and this court's own interpretations of 4123.512.
Counsel, before you begin, I have a factual question here. It wasn't very clear in the briefs. The statute says the party filing the appeal shall serve a copy of the notice of appeal on the administrator at the central office of the Bureau of Workers' Compensation in Columbus. Was that, in fact, done?
No, Your Honor, it wasn't. I think there is some confusion in the Second District's opinion. They make reference to a service on Joseph Gruber, who it turns out is a private attorney in Cincinnati who represented the third-party administrator of the employer. The Second District, for some reason, thought he had some connection to the Bureau of Workers' Compensation. But in the record, there is, in the employer's response to the motion to reconsider, there is attached from this court's website information about Mr. Gruber showing that he is a private attorney in Cincinnati and is not connected to the BWC.
In the notice of appeal itself, was the administrator listed as a party?
No, Your Honor, it was not. Starting with the text and the history of the statute, it contains three indications, each drawing on established precedents of this court, showing that the General Assembly intended the naming and serving requirements to be jurisdictional. First is the nature of the statute itself. This court has repeatedly held that when a statute defines and confers a right to appeal, that the appeal may only be taken in the manner prescribed by the statute. Here, the statute prescribes the right to appeal by requiring naming and service of the administrator of the BWC. A second textual clue is that the naming and serving requirements are introduced by shall language. This court has repeatedly held that shall is the language of legislative command. It introduces a mandatory command to the actor. Here, both the naming requirement and the serving requirement are introduced by shall language, indicating that in a jurisdiction conferring statute, that is a jurisdictional prerequisite. Finally, and most significantly, textually, is a 1989 change to the statute. Prior to 1989, the statute read that filing a notice of appeal is the only act necessary to perfect the appeal and vest the court with jurisdiction. In 1989, the General Assembly removed that second clause, vest the court with jurisdiction. That is an unmistakable signal that the General Assembly in 1989 made the jurisdictional inquiry more searching. It upped the jurisdictional ante in a way that was not present before removing that statutory language.
If I read the Court of Appeals opinion correctly, they stated that the plain language of the statute only requires the notice of appeal to state five factors set forth at being no obligation to name the administrator personally, and the jurisdiction depends on the timely filing of the notice, not the naming of the administrator. I assume you don't agree with that statement.
That's right, Justice O'Donnell, we do not. The Second District assigns significance, and we would say unwarranted significance, to the fact that the elements you just read off, that the notice of appeal must contain the name of the employer and the employee and the number of the claim, are in a separate paragraph of 41.23.512b from the other requirements that we're here discussing to name and serve the administrator.
So it's in addition to naming and serving the administrator, the notice of appeal has to contain all this other information.
That's right, Your Honor. We would say that those paragraphs set out separate jurisdictional requirements, just as 41.23.512a sets forth yet another jurisdictional requirement, and that is that only certain common pleas courts have jurisdiction, the place of injury or the place of employment. All of those are jurisdictional, and the Second District's assigning significance to the fact that those are in different paragraphs is not borne out by the textual clues that we've just talked about, especially the 1989 change, which at the very least...
Go ahead.
Counsel would...
No, go ahead. Oh. Did you finish?
Sure, I saw a question coming.
A question on the elements needed. What would your position be if there had been an application for the commission to be made a party, but the commission was not made a party? Would you say that was jurisdictional as well? Mainly because it's in the same sentence that we're talking about here.
Yes, Your Honor, we would. If the commission made an application to be made a party and was not, we would consider that jurisdictional.
Because that's in the sentence that says, the administrator of workers' comp, the claimant, and the employer shall be parties to the appeal, and the court, upon the application of the commission, shall make the commission a party. So you're saying all of that, along with the first sentence in B, becomes jurisdictional.
That's right, Your Honor. There was no application here, but we would say both paragraphs of B and the part of 512A that we discussed are all jurisdictional requirements.
So I see jurisdiction and necessary parties as two separate things. In this case, we're talking about a matter of a couple of months where the administrator was served, and under Civil Rule 15, you're allowed to amend and to add additional parties. I don't understand that your contention that it has to be jurisdictional.
Sure, Your Honor, several points there. First, we would say that the rules governing necessary parties do not apply to statute defining jurisdiction. I think that is a lesson that we could draw from this court's Hartsock versus Chrysler decision, where it considered the difference in the statute for the county of filing requirement, that is specific to the workers' compensation statute, and is different from the civil rules governing venue. And what this court held in Hartsock is the statute controls. The civil rules, although they're more lenient on this topic, do not control because the statute defines and delimits the right to appeal. A similar decision is this court's Hansford decision, really considering the same difference between a county filing rule in a statute and the civil venue rules there in the unemployment compensation review context. All of this discussion of the text, Your Honor, I think is buttressed by looking at other portions of 41.23, which helps us understand why the General Assembly enacted a bright-line rule of jurisdiction. By statute, the administrator of the Bureau of Workers' Compensation has an obligation to inform the employer of the consequences of not pursuing the appeal. That is only possible and is most effectually possible when the administrator has day one rights to participate and has notice of the appeal. We also are confronting a workers' compensation system where there are each year 24,000 staff hearing officer decisions, and about 8,000 of those each year are appealed. For the administrator to keep a handle on all of those cases and to fulfill his obligation to the state fund and the surplus fund, the best way for him to keep a handle on those cases is to have day one notice and participation rights in all of these 512 appeals.
But if we would disagree with your position and permit the administrator to be made a party, though not named in the notice of appeal, what prejudice falls to the administrator as a result of being named not in the initial notice of appeal, but a month or two or 90 days later?
Sure, Justice O'Donnell. I think there are several consequences, not only to the administrator, but at least systemically to the claimants and employers. To start with the consequences to the administrator, I mentioned the statutory obligation of the administrator to protect the state insurance fund and the surplus fund. To adequately protect those, the administrator needs day one notice and participation rights, first, to protect the development of the law, which changes rapidly when there are 8,000 cases a year, but more directly.
It wouldn't change in the first 30 days or 60 days. I mean, I don't think anyone's saying that the administrator should not be named, but the question we really have is whether it's named in the notice of appeal and becomes jurisdictional such that the case gets dismissed if it's not done.
Right, Your Honor. In this case, it was near 30 days, but certainly there's nothing to say that in other cases it's not 60, 90, or 120 days. But there are consequences, even the difference between day one and day 30. One of those is the ability to protect the state fund and the surplus fund from expenses it may bear when the right answer is settlement in the case, and that is the right answer in 95% of these 8,000 cases. Settlement early turns off the meter for expenses the fund may bear, such as transcript costs and attorney's fees. If settlement is the appropriate resolution of the case, that meter doesn't keep running against the fund, and that allows the administrator to fulfill his fiduciary duty to the fund and all of its constituents.
Counsel, how could there be a settlement if the administrator is to be a party and they weren't notified, whether it's jurisdictional or not? And if the proceedings had proceeded along the way, wouldn't they have to stop and start back over once the administrator is joined as a party? Or is the concern here that the administrator would never be joined as a party because they're never getting notice?
Certainly, that is one possibility, is the administrator never having notice, and that the administrator, settlements taking place without the administrator's participation are a worst-case scenario. But I think you also identify a problem of the administrator coming in, say, day 30 or later. That causes disadvantage, systemically at least, to claimants and employers, because no one wants in this high volume, sometimes thin margin practice to have the administrator showing up late and there be additional litigation about his right to participate, about the prejudice to either party, or at the very least, retracing or resetting litigation that has already gone down the road a bit and then is
Counsel,
reset.
Counsel, if we rule in this case to sustain or to affirm the lower court, that kind of takes care of that problem, doesn't it? The role of the administrator and the ability to bring the administrator in for these settlement negotiations?
I'm sorry, I'm not sure I followed that question, Your Honor.
Well, if the fact that the administrator was not named in the notice and was a party come lately to the case, and you're saying if it's 30 days down the road or 45 days or whatever, it's so far down the road that the administrator is disadvantaged, correct?
No, I'm not saying, well, the administrator is disadvantaged.
And the process itself is disadvantaged because the administrator is not at the table to facilitate any negotiations for settlement, et cetera.
Yes, Your Honor, that's the disadvantage to the administrator, is by not effectuating settlement, as is one of his roles in the three-way triangulation of these kind of cases. That allows awards to accrue against, say, the state fund that would otherwise be avoided because settlement would stop the accrual of those costs.
Okay, and then you also said that if the administrator was allowed to be named later, there would be litigation as to whether that was appropriate and whether the administrator, just the type of litigation we're having right here.
Well, right. There could be litigation about the administrator's right to participate. I think that's probably a minor concern, but
well, right,
more significant.
Well, right, because whatever we do here is going to decide that question, and you're not going to need to litigate it in the future because you'll have this case to, either side will have this case to apply.
Well, it's certainly our hope that this case will resolve in the administrator's favor his absolute right to participate, but I think there is a systemic problem to employers and employees if the administrator participates late. So if it is not a jurisdictional rule, as we urge here, and the administrator comes in later in the process, that causes retracing or resetting of litigation, additional steps in the litigation that would not be necessary if there's a bright line jurisdictional rule from day one.
But counsel, can I ask you, how do you reconcile 4123.512A that says the filing of the notice of appeal with the court is the only act required to perfect the appeal?
Yes, Your Honor, I would point to the 1989 change that I mentioned earlier. Before 1989, that same sentence read that filing the notice of appeal is the only act necessary to perfect the appeal and vest the court with jurisdiction. In 1989, the General Assembly struck that language, which to us is a definite signal that there is more to jurisdiction than just filing the notice of appeal. That relates only to perfecting the appeal, bringing the case to the court that then makes a jurisdictional analysis.
And in subsection B, it says the notice of appeal shall state the names of the claimant and the employer, but it doesn't say the administrator of the fund.
That's right. That is contained.
Would that be a legislative fix as opposed to a judicial interpretation?
We don't think so, Your Honor. The requirement that the administrator be a party and be served are in the very next paragraphs.
Yes.
And Section A also states if no common pleas court has jurisdiction for purposes of an appeal by the use of the jurisdictional requirements described in this division. So you're taking it that this entire section should be read as jurisdictional.
We think there are at least three jurisdictional requirements. They are in A, the part that Your Honor identifies, the county of filing requirement. Then there are the five requirements in the first paragraph of 512B, and then the requirements we're discussing here, those in the second paragraph of 512B. See, I have, the clock is counting up here, so I will try to stand up for rebuttal if you allow it. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Fulton, my understanding is that you will be taking 5 minutes.
Yes, Your Honor.
And you are here on behalf of the amici?
That's correct, Your Honor. I'm here on behalf of both amici curiae, OACC and OAJ. And Madam Chief Justice, and may it please the court. Your Honors, the appellant's position conflates a procedural issue, that is having necessary parties to a case, which applies not just here, but for example, in a subrogation case as well, with making an additional jurisdictional hurdle on a claimant to a workers' compensation case.
Under your theory, when would, or is it even necessary to have the administrator as a party?
It is necessary to have the administrator as a party, and the statute makes that clear.
When does that happen then?
It would happen very quickly in a case as a practical matter, generally.
Let's say it doesn't happen for 6 months. Is that case out or is that still curable in your opinion?
It's certainly curable with a Rule 19 joinder. I don't think as a practical matter it would ever take 6 months to happen, Your Honor. I think that an initial case management, it's similar to a subrogation case where an insurer.
The basic reading of it then is there is no time limitation required for joining the administrator. Once A satisfied, your case is there, it goes forward, and somewhere down the road, someone should notify the administrator under B. That's your reading?
Correct, Your Honor. Yes, my reading is that.
What happens if they try the case without the administrator? Is that then void?
Again, I think as a practical matter, that would never happen because the court, it's to me analogous to a subrogation case where an insurer needs to be a party, and perhaps they weren't named initially, but at some point that party is certainly going to be brought in because they're the real party in interest, and that's why we have mandatory joinder under Rule 19, and it's the court can act sua sponte or.
So that could even happen on the day of trial.
It could. I find it very hard to believe that would happen, but we're faced with the alternative of.
The rule you want us to write, it will say that at any point up until the day of trial, they could be brought in under B.
I would phrase it differently, Your Honor. I would say that what we're saying here is that the statute clearly states that all that's required for jurisdiction, which, as we all know, jurisdiction, if it's not met and the appellant's position is to create an additional jurisdictional hurdle, that case is gone. Our position is that the second paragraph of the section B of 512 lays out who are necessary parties. And while those are necessary parties, it is not a jurisdictional hurdle that those are named in the notice of appeal.
How do you reconcile those with our tax commissioner cases that require the tax commissioner to be served?
Well, I think that, and I think again that service again is separate than jurisdictional. I think that, again, as a practical matter, many times the complaint will name the administrator as a party. Again, we're talking about a sort of as you are all well aware, the workers' compensation system has many sort of strange nooks and crannies to it, and the notice of appeal is a specific thing to that system, basically just creating, as this court recognized in Fisher, just basically vesting, it's a way to vest jurisdiction in the proper court.
Mr. Fulton, what is the customary practice on naming the administrator? What is the custom in the industry among those who regularly practice
that? Sure, and obviously I can only speak for so much to that, but the customary practice is to name the administrator in this notice of appeal. I think, though, that what we're looking at here is a situation where the workers' compensation system, as it's created, was essentially created as a way to avoid common law procedural issues, to reach quick and judicious and efficacious resolutions of, as the appellant pointed out, thousands of cases. And so the entire purpose of the system was to prevent these sort of technicalities from preventing claims. And in this court's, to this court's benefit, the court has realized this over the last, originally, this court.
Counsel, I know your time is short here, but the main issue or problem that could arise is that the claimant and the employer may want to settle this case in a way that, for example, this case may be outside the experience of the employer. So the employer has no real interest in defending it because it's all going to be paid by other employers through the fund. And so the parties, the claimant and the employer, settled this case. The administrator wasn't included on the notice of appeal, was not served with the notice of appeal. The court is just happy to get rid of this case. There is nothing, if it's not jurisdictional, that would undo that settlement unless this is jurisdictional, at least according to the argument. What is your response to that?
With all due respect, Your Honor, I have a tough time taking it seriously that that would actually happen as a practical matter, because the parties, frankly, if it's a state fund case, they cannot reach a settlement.
Do you agree that it could happen, though?
I actually disagree. I do not think it could happen, because with a state fund case, the monies have to come from the Bureau of Workers' Compensation. That settlement has to go through a process to get approved. The employer doesn't have a right to say that we're going to pay someone else's money any more than they
Counsel,
could say that for.
Counsel, are you saying there's no strategic reason why you would not name the Bureau of Workers' Comp Administrator?
Correct.
So
absolutely.
This is just a mistake on the behalf of the lawyer for the employee. So we've got one incident, because you just said to Justice Kupp this would never, ever happen. It would never get down the parade of horribles and end up with the Bureau being on the hook and not having representation. So we are here to make law for one lawyer's mistake in representing a client, and we have to have this rule explained and applied because of that.
I do agree, Your Honor, that we are here because they, I don't know if I would say it was a mistake, because I frankly think the statute as the second
said it's customary and it's universally done that the administrator is named, and it would never get as far as Justice Kupp mentioned without the administrator being part of it.
I would say it's customary. I can't say it's universally done. But what I will say is that if it does happen in the future, accepting the appellant's position, some claimant will essentially have an additional jurisdictional burden, and some claimant will have their case dismissed on a jurisdictional technicality and not decide on the merits. If you follow what the second
Based
district did
on their lawyer's failure to name the Bureau.
Or, as you are well aware, in the workers' compensation system, there are quite a few pro se claimants and pro se plaintiffs who could be filing their own, which is, frankly, more of my concern here. But simply following the second district, all that happens is, as a routine matter, the parties will bring in, or the court will bring in, the administrator as a party under joinder rules. So there's, on one side, there's very little harm, if any, done by just upholding the second district's position. On the other side, this court is going away from, as I said, in Fisher and in decades of jurisprudence, reducing the jurisdictional burdens under 512. I, with all due respect, I think the claimant is misstating the purpose of the 1989 change to the 512. That was to, as it was initially interpreted, venue was an additional jurisdictional requirement. And essentially, if a claimant filed in the wrong venue, their case was gone as a subject matter, jurisdiction matter. The legislature, trying just like this court, has to interpret and use 512 as a way to reduce jurisdictional burdens made venue not specifically not a jurisdictional matter, and that is why 512A now says that the notice of appeal is the only thing required to vest jurisdiction, and it provides the court the sua sponte ability to transfer to the appropriate venue.
So you're saying to perfect the appeal means the same thing as to vest jurisdiction?
Correct. Correct.
That's your position.
Yes, correct. And we think, and if the administrator, I hear several policy arguments, which you know, I don't doubt have some merit about administrative ease with dealing with a large caseload, and you know, making sure the administrator is involved for settlement purposes. But the easiest way to fix this is just simply for the Attorney General's office to go to the General Assembly, the body entrusted as workers' compensation as a creature of statute with the law, and make the notice of appeal contain the administrator, because as it's written right now, there must be some reason for why the administrator is in a separate paragraph than what 512B specifically says is these are the five things that have to be contained in the notice of appeal. The administrator is not part of that. And while policy arguments are all well and good, it's not the role of this court to use policy arguments to change the plain language of 512's text.
Thank you, Mr. Fulton.
Thank you.
Mr. Hendershot, you've used all your time. You may take 30 seconds.
Thank you, Your Honor. The role of this court is to write a rule that systemically affects the workers' compensation system, and systemically a rule that makes...
Does this happen repeatedly?
It happens at least the dozen times that come up through the Court of Appeals decisions that we know underlie what's brought the case to this court. So they're the same.
How many districts have joined the second district in this type of decision, allowing for a non-jurisdictional?
Right. By our count, Your Honor, the 10th and 11th district have issued decisions similar to the second district. I would note that all three of those districts, though, reach back to a 1961 Common Pleas Court decision out of Summit County that relied on the language that was changed in 1989. So,
and how many districts, to your knowledge, go the other way?
By my count, there are four. So the 5th, 6th, 3rd, and 9th district. And significantly, the 9th district, which covers Summit County, has really overruled that 1961 case.
So one of the reasons for us to entertain this question is because of this announced conflicting of appellate districts on this question as to the jurisdictional aspect of naming the administrator.
Absolutely, Your Honor. The second district did not certify a conflict, but we would say that was in error.
But based on
the
case decisions and your research, there is a widespread disparity around the state on this particular issue.
Certainly. On that point of law, there is an almost even split between the districts.
Thank you.
What does to perfect an appeal mean? I mean, if it doesn't mean to vest jurisdiction in the court.
Your Honor, we would say that it means to bring the case to the attention of the court that then conducts a jurisdictional analysis. The 1989 removal of that vest the court with jurisdiction language must have some meaning. That removal is presumed to change the law because it was an amendment to the existing statute.
Thank you, Mr. Henshaw.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, gentlemen. We will take the matter under advisement, and you'll be notified of our decision. Marshall, would you call a recess?